Hey, MWI podcast listeners, before we get to this episode, I want to briefly tell you about a really interesting opportunity that some of you are eligible for. If you follow MWI, you're probably familiar with the Harding Project. Well, the Harding Fellowship prepares Army leaders to play a key role in the Army's most important professional discussions. Harding Fellows earn a graduate degree and then edit their branch journals, helping to shape the ideas that shape the Army. Eligibility includes Army officers, senior NCOs, and warrant officers. So if you're interested or you know somebody that might be, find out more about the fellowship program by visiting www.lineofdeparture.army.mil/Harding.
Hard target defeat requires some fidelity on how much penetration you want, and then a delayed fuse so that you give the weapon time to go through the rock or the steel or the concrete. What we've tried to do previously with hard targets is what's called consecutive miracles, which is the idea of using one weapon to blow a hole into the earth and then put another weapon in the same hole that allows it to get further penetration capability.
Hey, welcome back to the MWI podcast, brought to you with the generous support of the West Point class of 1974. I'm John Amble, and this episode features a pretty timely and relevant discussion. As I'm sure you all know, recently the United States conducted a series of strikes against targets associated with Iran's nuclear program. Those strikes employed a munition called the GBU-57, a large bomb designed to penetrate hardened and deeply buried targets and dropped from the B-2, one of the U.S. Air Force's strategic bombers. But how does the GBU-57 actually work? And what's it like to fly this type of long-range bomber mission in a B-2? My guest on this episode is uniquely qualified to speak to both questions. Dr. Melvin D'Ailey teaches at the U.S. Air Force's Air University. He is also a retired Air Force colonel and strategic bomber pilot with operational combat experience in the B-2. He joined me for a really insightful discussion that you're about to hear, but before we get to it, as always, just a couple quick notes. First, a very special thank you once again to the West Point class of 1974 for their generous support to MWI. And second, as always, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, here's my conversation with Mel D'Ailey. Mel, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of the MWI podcast.
Happy to be here.
So as I mentioned to you when I reached out to invite you on the podcast, for pretty obvious reasons, namely the U.S. operation to strike targets in Iran recently, there's been a pretty significant surge, I guess, in public discussion about what are colloquially known as bunker-busting munitions. The professional term is hard target defeat. As listeners heard in the intro, you teach at Air University, which is a U.S. Air Force professional military education institution. You're also a retired Air Force colonel who, you know, A, has some knowledge about these munitions and the problem set really that they were designed for, and B, you've flown two of the three strategic bombers in the U.S. Air Force inventory, the B-52 and the B-2, the B-2 being the aircraft that was used recently for those strikes in Iran. So, you know, I guess you're kind of the perfect guest to have on right now. I'm really looking forward to hearing your insights. And I guess I thought I'd begin by asking the big sort of framing question. When we hear the term bunker busters, what are the sort of, definitional left and right limits? What are we talking about?
So standard disclaimer, right? Anything I say is based on my personal experience or my previous training. Not a reflection of the Air Force, Department of Defense, or Air University. Hard target defeat is a problem that has reared its ugly head for decades, let's say. And what I mean by that is, how do you defeat a target that is either deeply buried underground? How do you defeat a target that is within rock? Or within reinforced concrete. And so over the decades, we have tried to do various things in order to defeat these targets. Some of the earlier versions of bunker busting, if you will, or going after hard and deeply buried targets involve things like skip bombing, which was this idea of trying to get a bomb down the entrance to a tunnel. We've practiced this with LG. Now, this is not something the B-2 is capable of, but this is what previous fighters would do, which is try to skip a bomb off the ground and have it go down a tunnel and blow up inside a tunnel that way. We've had a version threes of the JDAM. So when the JDAM first came out, 2000 pounder, there were version ones and version threes. Version ones were Mark 84 bomb bodies. These are your conventional, think Mark 84 bomb body, your conventional high explosive that was primarily used for blast and frag. But there was also a Blue 109 version, which is, again, a hard target defeat. The idea being to, you know, go after that reinforced concrete, that penetrating ability to get through, whether it's reinforced concrete with rebar or to get through hard rock. And then you have, now it came online after I left the B-2, but now you have the massive ordnance penetrator, MOP as it's commonly known. A GBU 57 is what it's designated as. It's a 5,000 pound class weapon. It says it's 30,000 pounds, but we typically class it by the explosive package. So 30,000 pounds, but 5,000 of that is conventional explosives.
So obviously this is a very large weapon. And as we've all heard a great deal lately, it's large enough that only the B-2 can carry it. So size does clearly play a role here, but it isn't just about payload size, right? You know, I'm glad you mentioned the JDAM, the Joint Direct Attack Munition. I don't remember if I talked to you about this before we began this discussion, but I was deployed to Iraq in 2008 during the Iraq troop surge, and I was on a forward operating base in East Baghdad. It was a hardened base, unlike many of the other FOBs that we had, and that was because it had been the headquarters of Saddam Hussein's Mukhabarat, the secret police under Saddam's regime. Given that role, unsurprisingly, it was among the targets struck before, you know, in the days ahead of the ground force invasion in 2003. And there was a building in the FOB. We called it the JDAM building because, unsurprisingly, we had dropped a JDAM on it. But I was always kind of struck by the pattern of destruction that it caused. It was about a four-story building, but the JDAM didn't bring down the entire building. It must have been kind of a dead center hit because it completely took out, destroyed all four levels in the center of the building, but it left this outer layer of rooms, I guess, what must have been offices, sort of the middle managers of Saddam's secret police went there to work every day. It left those intact. The engineers went and inspected it and said, hey, this is stable enough, we can use it. And we did. I don't remember if it was for office space or living quarters or what have you. But I remember, you know, it was kind of the first-hand impression that I got of kind of blast patterns and the particular patterns of destruction caused by munitions. And I've thought a lot about it, and I've been thinking about it a lot again in recent days for obvious reasons. So when we talk in terms of the effects that you want to deliver and how to deliver those effects, whether in, you know, 360 degrees and three dimensions or, you know, focused in one particular direction, I guess, you know, what goes into being able to do that, whether from the standpoint of engineering and design or one of weaponeering or even of employment?
So I would say that one, it requires somewhat high fidelity intelligence. In other words, these weapons go off when most hard target defeat weapons are not going to be proximity fused or contact fused or airburst. Right. So your conventional weapons, you can proximity fuse them so they go out at a certain altitude above the ground, or you can contact fuse them so when they touch the ground, right, they detonate. Hard target defeat requires some fidelity on how much penetration you want, and then a delayed fuse so that you give the weapon time to go through the rock or the steel or the concrete. And then once after you feel like the weapon is gone and through enough of that that it's in an area of air or a void, right, that's when you want to plan for the proximity or the time fuse to go off and detonate. Because the idea is you're not trying to blow up earth and rubble. You're actually trying to blow up what's inside the hard targeted area. So you account for, we don't know what altitudes the B-2s were flying at, but everything says, right, you want it to hit that weapon to hit a terminal, give enough altitude to hit a good terminal velocity to where it's going over the speed of sound. So when it hits, it's penetrating, and then you want to time the fuse so that once it gets to an area where there's a void or where there's air, right, that's where it's going to detonate and destroy the stuff that's under the earth or under the steel and concrete.
You know, maybe this is a dumb question, but as a non-specialist in this, I'm going to ask it on behalf of the other non-specialists among our listeners. Is it, is that penetration solely a function of the inertia of this weapon system?
Yeah, at least for the GBU 57, there's no rocket propeller that would make it go further into the ground. We're all using inertial and letting Sir Isaac Newton take over once the weapon departs the aircraft. A couple of considerations, though, and I think if you saw the CJCS brief, what General Kane said is, we control the impact angle, we program the impact angle, we program the heading plane. When he talks about these weapons, the idea is when you're doing hard target defeat, you want it to get, as in my opinion, you want it to get as close to perfectly vertical as possible, right? So any weapon, when it hits the earth, will tend to curve as it penetrates. So you want to get it as close to a right angle as possible. For JDAM employment, what people may not know is because these weapons have somewhat maneuvering capability, the ability to use inertial navigation linked to GPS to do some minor maneuvering, basically when you're releasing a JDAM or a MOP, you're basically releasing it in a 3D space that allows the weapon to use that inertial guidance to get to the target. So there's what we call a launch acceptability region or launch acceptability area that says, hey, your aircraft is within the 3D circle. If you release it now, it will get to the target at the parameters that you programmed it at. And what makes this mission this past weekend, or 2 weekends ago now, what makes that mission very successful is you had 14 of these things employed within a matter of, less than an hour, it appears, from all the briefings that we've seen unclassified. And all of these weapons were within very tight parameters dropped on, again, from what we understand, 12 MOPs at one location, 2 MOPs at another, at the Natanz, I believe. So these weapons were... it's very strict parameters to drop these weapons because of the idea that you're trying to get that 90 degree impact angle. You're trying to get enough inertia on it to where it will penetrate and then go off once it's reached the depth that it's programmed to go off at, or at least the time, right? It's just a matter of, I know how fast it's going to penetrate. I know how long I want it to penetrate before it gets to a void. Program that time in and then let the weapon go. Once it hits the earth, that timer will probably start to count down and then it'll go off, right? Once it's penetrated a certain number of seconds, milliseconds.
Using several munitions together like that to sort of compound the effects of one another, is that a doctrinal tactic or was this a particularly innovative employment case?
I would say that, previously, hard target defeat means we can do a couple of things. Again, I think what you saw from the CJCS brief is we don't want to necessarily just try to blow holes into harden, whether it's mountain, whether it's rebar, whether it's concrete. We just don't want to keep blowing holes into this stuff to eventually get to where we want to go. I think what you saw is you can do a couple of things to defeat hard targets. One is people underground need a source of air. And so when they're working, and so I think what you saw with the General Kane brief is there was an air, there are air shafts, right, to allow people who are working underground to get recycled air so they can breathe. And so that was one of the targets that we used, which is, right, a soft point when it comes to hard target defeat. So that's one thing you can do. The other thing you can do is basically a functional kill, if you will, which is I don't want people to have access to this area. So there are tunnel entrances or elevators, et cetera, right, that people have to use in order to get down to the deeply buried target. So you can close off access to that. Those are kind of the ways to defeat a hard target. If you don't want to just blow off, right, a bunch of rock and concrete to get down there, you can try to find what I would call the soft points or the access points that you're trying to deny people access to that area. If you close a tunnel, if you destroy an elevator, if you destroy an air source, right, that's going to kind of defeat the, at least functionally defeat the target that you're going after.
And, you know, without getting into any classification issues here, obviously, is there any way to put a finer point on what we mean by precision here? How precise are we talking?
So I'll use what somebody, right, one of the news accounts says that it's like trying to put a weapon in the size of a washing machine. I don't know that that's a good analogy, but I will say, right, what we've tried to do previously with hard targets is what's called consecutive miracles, which is the idea of using one weapon to blow a hole into the earth and then put another weapon in the same hole that allows it to get further penetration capability. And I think from what General Kane said, that was one of the target techniques or tactics that was used this past in Operation Midnight Hammer, which is, right, one target went in to the air shaft and then others went in, followed it, and destroyed other access to that hard target. So again, with GPS, you're trying to get, you're talking about putting multiple weapons into the same GPS coordinates. That's a very, that's a very difficult problem, but right, one that I think you saw from this past weekend that the B-2 was capable of doing using GPS. The other thing I'll say is, right, you know, a lot of people are trying to figure out how much damage was done. Well, the trouble is, right, when it comes just like in Iraq or other places, the trouble is trying to figure out what is the actual battle damage assessment. Now, you can do what's called battle impact assessment, BIA. You can look at the target area and you can see where the holes are. So you know that the weapon went in, you know that the weapon, right, probably, and then we had human intelligence, pilot reports, at least according to General Kane, that said, hey, we saw the weapon detonate. So you know that the weapon hit a particular hole, you know that the weapon did detonate based on human intelligence. But the only way to actually, in my opinion, the only way to actually figure out what the actual damage is two things. One, you have to visit that site yourself, or, right, like just after, like after Iraq, right, we had boots on the ground. We could have people go to targets that were hit by hard and deeply buried targeted weapons and sell us, hey, this is how well the weapon functioned. Or you have to, right, you have to have some kind of human, whether that be, you know, whether it's a spy or somebody you turn to go in there and tell you what the weapon actually did.
The way that public reporting on this strike has described the target, Fordow in particular, was that it was a facility in a mountain, under a mountain. When we talk about hardened targets, you know, there are lots of ways a target can be hardened, lots of materials that can be used. How much of that variable, the material variable, factors into, you know, mission planning? And does that mean that, you know, mission planning requires really engineers who can tell you how the weapon system is going to interact with any particular hardening materials?
Yeah, so there's a, and I would be hard-pressed to tell you what the current name of such capability is. But after the Gulf War, I'll just do a historical thing. After the Gulf War, we stood up a place called the Joint Warfare Analysis Center, I believe. I don't know what it may have migrated to today, but the idea is we have very good intelligence people who know how to get coordinates, who know how to look at a structure and tell you what you can target, but nothing is as good. So let's just use a petroleum facility, right? So we know that, yeah, you can blow up storage tanks, or we know that you can blow up certain cracking stations, et cetera. But if you have a petroleum person who can look at a target area and say, hey, that's the part you want to hit. We used to have this thing called the Joint Warfare Analysis Center. I don't know what it has morphed into, but the idea is to get industry experts that can look at targets and tell you where the right, where is the most vital area you need to hit in order to achieve the objective you're looking for. And so I would imagine that we do have people, I mean, now this is, we also have to understand this is that hard target defeat was something that was taken on by DARPA. They're supposedly the origins of the Massive Ordnance Penetrator is a DARPA initiative. And so they were the ones who started looking at hard target defeat, came up with the idea for the Massive Ordnance Penetrator. And that, and again, the B-2 is one of the few aircraft that can actually carry such a weapon.
Yeah, the fact that this is a solution to a problem that was assigned to DARPA, I think speaks to just how complicated it is, how multifaceted really it is as a military problem. Because, you know, I imagine that there's a limit to how much explosive power you can pack on and sort of tackle this challenge purely with brute strength. You really need some, I guess, some ingenuity behind it, which means it's going to have a certain, I guess, exquisiteness to its engineering. Right. Can you talk at all about kind of maybe some of the most important design considerations?
I would say that the biggest thing that you want when it comes to hard and deeply buried targets is you want a case structure, a bomb encasement material that will actually hold the weapon together while it's penetrating, whether, again, it's rebar and concrete or rock, that will hold the weapon together so that it does function when it is time for the weapon to function. In other words, you don't want the weapon to, you know, break apart and then you have just explosive material that doesn't go off because the weapon is, you know, breaks on impact or as it's penetrating, it starts to come apart. So this was, again, 5,000 pound explosive package, 30,000 pound weapon. So 25,000 pounds of that weapon was devoted to structure, guidance, fins, etc. Right? If that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. You have mentioned a couple of times, and we've talked about the fact that the B-2 is the only U.S. aircraft that can be used to drop this weapon system, the GBU-57. You flew the B-2, I guess, as well as the B-52, two of the U.S. Air Force's three strategic bombers. If you're flying a mission that employs this kind of munition, are there any kind of unique employment considerations when you get over the target?
Yeah, I would say so. I'll use my personal experience, right? So we had in Afghanistan, so I was fortunate enough, second night of Afghanistan, called upon, when ordered so by the president, to execute strikes in Afghanistan in response for 9/11. I flew the second night with myself and Colonel, now retired, Brian Neal. He and I were in the lead aircraft. We had our own particular route that we went on. The second aircraft had its own particular route. We did several target complexes on the first time in country that, again, were using conventional general purpose JDAMs, Mark 84 bomb bodies, 2,000 pounders. Whatever those targets were, they were targets that were in the open, whether it was runways or aircraft. When we came out of country, we still had four penetrating weapons that were given to us in case of a restrike possibility. When we exited Afghanistan, we were told to go back in and drop those four penetrating weapons on the target in Afghanistan. The one thing I'll say about that is, again, every JDAM has, or I should say every GPS, inertially guided GPS-fed weapon has a launch acceptability region, a 3D space that you release the weapon in order to make sure that it has the energy to get to the target. Because of these were penetrating weapons, that 3D space shrinks considerably because, again, you're trying to get a very different impact angle with the earth that you're trying to go after, and it just requires a little bit more finesse to get the aircraft into that launch acceptability region.
You described it as a 3D space. You're flying through that space at a, you know, at a particular speed and a particular trajectory. So is it possible to sort of convert that from space to time? How long is that window to drop the weapon?
That's going to be based on the target, the airspeed that you're going, and the altitude that you're delivering it from. A lot of factors that go into that. Again, the B-2 has several computers on board. What people may not know is, you know, this is a fly-by-wire aircraft. So it doesn't look like a traditional aircraft. So you're saying, how do you fly an aircraft that doesn't have, right, a rudder, an empennage in the back, and traditional flight control surfaces? How do you have a pilot fly that aircraft in the way that they know, so that when they step on the right rudder pedal, the nose goes right, step on left, it goes left, when you don't have a rudder? It's all fly-by-wire, right? So the computers take those inputs and translate them into something that enables the aircraft to perform like a pilot would expect it to perform. Those same computers are, right, calculating weapons release. And so, again, based on the airspeed that you're going, the parameters that you've said to the aircraft that you want to drop the weapon at, the altitude that you're at, it does a dynamic, right, calculation, generates the 3D space, and then the crew has to make sure that the aircraft is maneuvering into that space at the appropriate time, so that the weapon goes, right, so because every target still has a time over target, right, and you wanted to compress it as much as possible, I would imagine, with seven aircraft, you want to compress that as much as possible so that the enemy is caught off guard with the number of weapons that went off in the short amount of time that it appears that they did.
You know, it's been widely and publicly reported that these aircraft, the B-2s, flew from the United States, specifically from Missouri. That is a long mission. You have some experience with that sort of long mission. You flew what was at the time, and maybe still is, a record long bomber mission of more than 44 hours. So I guess I'm kind of curious just what that's like, particularly for a small crew, because, you know, different aircraft have different sizes of crew, but the B-2's crew size is pretty remarkably small, right?
Yeah, so there's only two people, two-person crew, a pilot and a mission commander. Pilot is responsible for basically flying the aircraft. Mission commander is responsible, I would say, for navigation and weapons delivery. Now, either pilot can do either mission. Either person on the crew can do either mission, but usually the person in the left seat is designated as the pilot. And the person in the right seat is designated as the person responsible for navigation, timing, weather avoidance, and weapons employment. What the rules require is that for takeoff, landing, air refueling, and bombing, the critical phases of flight, both crew members have to be in the seat to do the operation. Other than those four times, one person can clear out on our mission over Afghanistan. You saw 37 hours. That's looks like they went over the Atlantic, through the Med, into country, and then back. Our mission was a little bit longer because we went from Missouri to California, air refueled, went to Hawaii, air refueled, went to Guam, air refueled, and then the Straits of Malacca, Dover to Diego Garcia, our last air refueling prior to going into country, came out, air refueled again, went back into country, came out, air refueled, went down to Diego Garcia. In either instance, in between those air refuelings, and I think I've read open source reporting that says anywhere from 5 to 7 air refuelings in order to get the crews over target. So in between those air refuelings, one crew member can clear out their, on our mission, there was a cot behind the two seats, and crew members can, one crew member go back there, grab some shut eye until the next air refueling, and then you kind of rotate after that.
Since MWI is an Army organization, I'm going to make a kind of a land power comparison that might be familiar to any Army members or others who have deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan. Those were wars that have been described as, you know, long periods of inactivity, boredom even, punctuated by short, intense periods of frenetic and violent activity. You know, is that a reasonable analogy to make here to a mission like this, where, you know, obviously the actual bombing phase is intense, but I would imagine also the air refuelings. I mean, I've never done an air refueling, but I would also assume that that's a pretty intense phase as well, you know, with your pulse spiking when you've really got to be switched on. So I guess I'm curious, is there a sort of a rhythm to such a long mission?
Yeah, I would say that you're in between those periods, one person is responsible for one. I would say, you know, flying over the Pacific or the Atlantic, you're constantly on the watch for things like other aircraft, because, you know, you're not going to broadcast the fact that, hey, we're a bomber and we're on our way to X country. So making sure that you're still avoiding traffic is one of the number one concerns. Making sure you're avoiding weather is another concern. And then I would say that the other significant thing that the one pilot in the seat is doing is making sure that the timing is working out, because you have certain times that you have to meet each of your air refueling tankers, and you just want to make sure that you're constantly having the right airspeed to get there, because without those air refuelings, right, it's going to be a very short mission. So timing and navigation is another primary concern in those, you know, doldrum periods.
Is that a concern then, you know, kind of trying to stay switched on during those low periods, the doldrums, as you describe them, you know, or, you know, is there a certain energy that just sort of keeps you alert just from being involved in an important mission? Is it pretty much any time a B-2 launches, or is it, you know, is it a function of all the training that you undergo that helps keep you focused?
I would say, and I would think the same for the guys who flew this mission over in Iran or any of the previous bomber missions. My pilot and I, when we were identified as being part of the response to 9/11 crew, we would come in on a daily basis and practice, whether it be air refueling procedures or bombing procedures, just to make sure we've got the checklist down, make sure we've got the crew coordination down, which is what I'm sure that these seven crews did, just because you want to make sure you want to eliminate all sources of friction that are possible, because there will be things that don't go according to plan in any mission. And so if you can eliminate some of those sources by doing checklist procedures and stuff, you can try to eliminate as much of the source of error as possible, because there will be other things that go wrong that you're going to have to handle as a crew.
So to sort of zoom out, I've got a question in my head that I'm trying to figure out the best way to kind of formulate it. And maybe it's an impossible question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. The weapon system used in the Iran strikes, the GBU-57, is part of this category, as we've discussed, of hard target defeat munitions. But I also think it's fair to say that it's sort of in a class by itself, just in terms of its sheer capability. It's at the pinnacle of this category of munitions. If we project forward, you know, from what you know about the kind of development of these sorts of munitions, is it more likely that we'll see kind of incremental improvements on a sort of evolutionary pathway? Or is the next step forward, you know, assuming there is one, that we haven't run into the limits of just how much hardened material we can actually punch through, is that next step forward possibly going to be a revolutionary one, you know, like the one that was made with the introduction of the GPU 57, you know, compared to other hard target defeat munitions? Again, maybe that's an impossible question, but, you know, I guess, what do you think comes next in this sort of, you know, I guess small but significant corner of kind of the art and science of warfare?
I would say that the hard and deeply buried target class of targets is constantly growing. And the reason being is because more and more countries see our capability for what we could do, whether it's in Afghanistan, whether it's in OIF. As you know, once the JDAM made its combat debut in OAF, Operation Allied Force, in 1999, once that other nations saw the precision capability, that the all-weather precision capability that the Air Force and the Joint Force has, whether it's OAF, OEF, OIF, they now realize, right, the way to defeat that is to go further and further underground. I think what you'll see after the employment of the MOP is now the idea is try and build a better mousetrap, right? So how do we take something even further underground or reinforce it? Again, I think the one thing with the MOP is we knew about this capability. We've never seen it employed. We have now. I think it'll be it'll be weeks to years before we fully know, right, how effective this weapon was, because again, you got to put eyes on in order to understand how it functioned. I think we do know, though, that the weapon did function as it did function, because we have reports of explosions and secondaries. So yes, I think this was a solution specifically for, right, this target set, which was the Iranian centrifuges. There are other target sets out there that could be even further buried, or that the enemy may now even try to look at how do we harden it so that you can't get to it with a MOP. And that will require, right, some more ingenuity.
Well, as we wrap up, I think it's worth emphasizing just what a fascinating military problem hard target defeat is objectively, and how important it is to combine, you know, the big brains at DARPA and engineers to design and build a solution to that problem, along with, you know, skilled planners to figure out how to employ that solution. And then, you know, finally, talented aviators to actually go do it.
Yes. And I would say that we do have, again, we have DITRA. We also have, right, other contractors and intelligence organizations devoted to the idea of hard target defeat. It is probably, you know, number one on the list of, again, following Iraq, Afghanistan, you know how well the JDAM works and how well we can find targets and defeat them. Hard targets are, right, the class of weapons that still require ingenuity and weapons.
Well, Mel, I want to thank you again for making some time to chat with me today. It's a really interesting subject, obviously a very relevant one right now. And I trust the listeners will appreciate the chance to hear your insights.
All right. Thank you.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing, if you aren't yet following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.